This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. There are many reasons to know, and frankly love, some of the roles by Michael Caine. He was Alfred the Butler in the Batman trilogy, the one that Chris Nolan did. He made his name as an actor in Alfie, as the title character from the 1966 movie. And then there's this.
3, 2, 1, go. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off!
That moment from The Italian Job in 1969 eclipses all others, even the final line from that movie.
Hang on a minute, lads. I've got a great idea.
The Italian Job inspired the title of Michael Caine's new book, Blowing the Bloody Doors Off, and Other Lessons in Life. He joined us last week from the BBC in London, and the first thing we talked about was his quote-unquote retirement from movie making back in the 90s. I asked him what made him want to stop and what brought him back.
What made me want to stop was I got a script, and I'd send it back to the producer saying I didn't want to play it, the part was too small, and he sent it back saying, I didn't want you to read The Lover, I wanted you to read The Father. And I thought, oh, my God, my career's over. To be a movie star, you have to get the girl. You know that. Everyone knows that. You get the girl. I didn't get the girl in this. I was her father. So I'd gone from a star. I was going to go from a star to a character actor. You know, and I thought, I'm not doing this. To hell with it. So I gave up, and I took a place in Miami for the winter. I got an apartment there. I opened a restaurant. I had a couple of restaurants in London, so I knew what I was doing. And I settled down in the winter there to write my autobiography about my career, which was called The Elephant to Hollywood, because I was brought up in a district in London called The Elephant and Castle. I gave up, you know. And down there, living near me, was Jack Nicholson, and we became friends. And then one day Jack said to me, he said, I've got a script called Blood and Wine, and there's a wonderful part in it for you. You want to read it? And I thought, well, obviously Jack's the star of it, you know, not me. I'm going to be a character actor. What do you think about that, Michael? I said to myself. And I thought, and I read the script and I thought, great. And I'd been working with Jack, who's one of my favourite actors ever. I made the movie and it went well and I was very happy. So I came back into the business. And it was one of the reasons I wrote the book, because it was, you know, don't, if you give up, question it a little bit any time you think you do, especially old age, because there may be another couple of years in it for you. And when, as I said, I was 61, 60, 62 then. I'm now 85 and I'm making a movie, and I'm absolutely enjoying my life just as much as I ever did.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Capital One. Here's Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One, on how the CreditWise app helps users take action after receiving one of its automatic credit alerts.
It's not just an alert, but it's also, here are the next steps that we recommend you do. And so hopefully that's giving our users the opportunity to feel empowered to go after the issue and resolve it.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Giving up seems to be one of the themes in terms of the advice that you were given that comes up in the book quite a bit. You write in part, most of the advice I received in the first 30 years of my life can be very quickly summarized. Give up. Why did so many people try to convince you to quit?
Well, I wasn't great looking, and I had a thick Cockney accent in a very class conscious country, which was before the 60s England. And to become an actor, you know, I would, what they saw, they didn't see a big career for me. They were very understanding people. They realized I'd get parts, but I would be the policeman who would come in at the end of the film and take the criminal away when he was arrested or something like that. They knew there was no career in it for me. It was just a job. And I, in actual fact, accepted that. Because at that time, I knew that I would never be rich or famous. And I'd seen a lot of young people on television talking about being rich, what they wanted to do with their lives. And many of them answered, I want to be rich and famous. And I thought that was the wrong idea. And apart from the old age thing, the other reason I wrote the book was that I started, you should not do things that you want to do with your life in order to be rich and famous. You should do it to be the best you could be at what you chose to do. So all you have to do is to be as best, the best you can possibly be. And to this day in my life, I still try to be better than I was the last time.
Could you explain this term? I hear people throw this term around of being a character actor. What does that mean? Particularly, what does that mean to you?
Character actor. Yeah, well, the first thing it means is you don't get the girl.
You just cut that out.
Yeah. And what it is that if you are a handsome young man and you're playing a handsome young man, well, you've got a nice start, you know, in the role. But what if you're a character actor, you will be playing an accent that isn't yours, you know. I won an Academy Award for the Sidehouse Rules playing an American, you know. And I'm known as a Cockney actor.
Right.
And you're always playing characters that do not look like you. The part I'm playing at the moment, they stick a moustache and a beard on me every day, you know, and the glue is horrible, and it makes your face all red when you get it off. And you're always as far away from you as you can possibly get. And the farthest away from me that I ever got was in a movie called Youth, which I did with Paolo Sorrentino, which is a fabulous Italian director. And it was a wonderful movie and a wonderful part for me. I played the conductor of a symphony orchestra conductor. If you think in terms of a Cockney symphony orchestra conductor, that was as far away as I got. And I won my first European Academy Award for that. So I was very happy with that. And that has been my life, is to play as difficult a role as far away from me as possible and make a success of it. And Youth did that for me.
One of the big themes of the book is about advice and about kind of dispensing some of the advice that you have received over the years. I felt like very early on in the book, one of the things that you were trying to convey, and correct me if I'm wrong, was not just what you've learned over your life and your career and the advice you wanted to impart, but also how to receive advice, how to know who to listen to and what to do with the advice in life that you get. Am I reading you right?
Oh, yeah. I think it's very important that you've got to sort out advice that is good. Because five of the first producers I ever went to for a job told me to give up. That was their advice. And they said, you're not going anywhere, Michael. I mean, look in the mirror, look at you, you know, your accent, listen to your accent. They said, you're not going anywhere. You'll get small parts in pictures as policemen or firemen or something, but just give up. But then you get great advice, and you get funny advice. I mean, John Wayne. I was in Hollywood in a hotel lobby when John Wayne was years ago when John Wayne was registering, and he saw me standing there. I was looking at him. It was John Wayne. Blimey, fantastic. I'd just got to Hollywood, and I was living in the Beverly Hills Hotel waiting for Shirley MacLaine to turn up, because she was late, a couple of days late on a movie. I was going to do a movie called Gambit with her, because she'd seen Alfie, and she put me in a movie with her. And I was in Hollywood, but I didn't know anybody, so I stayed for a week in a hotel room on my own and never did anything. So I went to the lobby to look for film stars. One day John Wayne came in, and while he was registering, he looked over at me and he said, what's your name, kid? I said, Michael Caine. He said, you're in that movie, Alfie? I said, yeah, I am. He said, we ran that at home. You know, they ran movies at home, Hollywood stars. He said, we ran that movie the other night, kid. He said, and let me tell you, you're going to be a star. I said, well, thank you, Mr. Wayne. Thank you very much. He said, well, let me give you some advice. I said, what advice, sir? He said, talk low, talk slow, and don't say too much. I said, okay, thank you. He said, and I had on suede shoes. And he looked down and he said, and never wear suede shoes. I said, what? He said, never wear suede shoes. I said, why not? He said, well, I just told you, you're going to be a movie star. He said, you're going to be famous. He said, you'll be in a gent's toilet taking a pee one day, and the guy next to you is going to turn and recognize you, and he's going to say, Michael Caine, and he's going to pee all over your shoes. So never wear suede shoes, kid.
Just some plain old canvas will do the trick. That must have been intimidating, you know, getting advice from the Duke himself. I'm sure when you first got there, you were like, yes, this is gospel. I'm going to do everything you said.
Yeah, at one point I called him John. He said, you never call me Don, kid. You call me Duke or Mr. Wayne.
That must have been kind of an honor, but also intimidating when you kind of arrive and you start getting advice and you don't have anything else to balance it off against or judge it against, like, it's gospel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was fabulous for me. I mean, I'd never met famous people, you know. I wasn't a success in the theater. And I was doing this movie with Shirley MacLaine called Gambit. And one night she said, I want you to take me to dinner. I said, okay, I'll do anything. What do you want? I said, well, what restaurant are we going to? She said, we're not going to a restaurant. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to Danny Kaye's house. I went, Danny Kaye's? I go, oh, my God. I said, what food we have there? She said, he's a very good Chinese cook. He said, he's very famous, and you eat Chinese food in the kitchen. I said, oh, that would be fantastic. And I went there, and there were two other men in the room, in the kitchen. Only two men, no one else, just us, Shirley and me and Danny, and two men. One was Cary Grant, and the other one was the Duke of Edinburgh.
Huh.
And that's the most name-dropping meal I've ever had in my life. I couldn't understand why anyone was there and what they were doing. But I understood later, any time anyone got invited to Chinese food at Danny Kaye's house, they went, because it was fabulous. But I did notice a Chinese man standing in the background somewhere, you know.
You've talked about some of the roles that kind of surprised you in terms of the quality of them, the most interesting roles. You wrote that as you have aged, the parts got more interesting. And as a comic book geek, I have to say one of my favorite series of roles that you have played was Alfred Pennyworth, who is Bruce Wayne's butler in the Batman movies, the trilogy that was directed by Christopher Nolan. Here is a scene from the second movie, from The Dark Knight, between you and Bruce Wayne, played by Christian Bale, as you're trying to advise Bruce on this crazy character who seems to just attack Gotham City illogically. You're explaining to Batman how to track the Joker.
One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal them?
Well, because he thought it was good sport. Because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Michael Caine as Alfred the butler in The Dark Knight. What makes you laugh about that?
Oh, I'm so happy with it. I got it right. You know, a reporter once said to me, what was the greatest love scene you ever did in a movie? I said, saying goodbye to Batman in The Dark Knight.
Really?
And I meant it.
Why is that?
Because the affection that we all held for each other as characters and as actors on that series was fabulous.
I got to say, that movie, Dark Knight, in my opinion, is the greatest comic book movie ever made. Because it's not about,
so too, yeah.
It's not about, like, I am going to rule the world or I'm going to destroy the world. It's this psychological drama about order versus chaos. And that scene that Batman and the Joker have in the interrogation room at the Major Crimes Unit is just, like, I've never seen anything like that on film. Yeah. But I wonder if you saw that in the movie from the beginning, if you kind of knew it was going to have that kind of punch.
I knew, I'd already done two Batmans.
I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, when Chris Nolan, the director, first came to you and kind of introduced you to this idea, were you skeptical at first or were you sold on it?
Oh, I was really skeptical. I mean, he came to me on a Sunday morning and he came to my front door, which was glass, and I could see him. So I answered the door and I didn't know who it was, but I could see a script in his hand. And then he said his name, and I knew who it was immediately because he'd made three fabulous small movies, you know. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to be in one of these marvellous small movies. Maybe I'll get nominated for an Oscar. It'll be marvellous. And he said, well, I'm doing a movie and I'd like you to be in it. I said, what's it called? He said, Batman Begins. I said, a Batman movie? He said, yes. It was a surprise to me. I mean, this is a big epic. And there was this brilliant young artistic movie director of small movies, you know. And I said, Batman. So I thought to myself for a moment, I thought, well, I'm too old to play Batman. I think he wants me to play the butler. So I said, well, what part would you like me for? And he said, the butler. I said, oh, really, the butler? I said, what do I say? Dinner is served. Would you like another glass of red wine? Coffee, anyone? He said, Michael, the butler was his foster father, Batman's foster father. His father died. He said, it's much more than that. Go and read the script. I said, well, okay, well, I'll send my driver with it tomorrow. He lived near me then. I said, I'll read it today. I said, and I'll send it back tomorrow. He said, no, I want you to read it now and give me the script back, because Chris is very secretive about his work. And I read the script, fell in love with it, and did the part, and sort of fell in love with Chris because we did seven movies together.
Right.
And he always said to me, you're my lucky charm. I wouldn't make a film without you in it. And when he got to Dunkirk, there wasn't a film for an old man in Dunkirk. I was, 75, 80. Well, also, Chris and his brother, they wrote those scripts.
Right.
And they're brilliant writers, absolutely fabulous. And I loved it. But there wasn't a part for me in Dunkirk. So in the war movie, there's all pilots talking to the squadron leader at the airport, from the airplane. And you don't see him. You just hear his voice talking to the pilots in the combat. And that voice is me. Right. That's the first voice you hear in Dunkirk. And it worked because it made a fortune.
We're speaking to Michael Caine, who's known for being a character actor and also known for that accent of his that people love to imitate. But what does he think of all those impressions? Does anybody do a good one? That's ahead. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Hinge. Hinge is the dating app that's great at one thing, setting you up on great dates. And they're not just saying that. On Hinge, 3 out of 4 first dates lead to second dates. They are the number one mobile first dating app mentioned in the New York Times wedding section. So if you're looking for a BFF, a job, a pen pal, or a hookup, Hinge isn't the place for you. Hinge is exclusively designed to get you out on great dates. Download Hinge in the Apple Store or Google Play.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
One of the most distinctive things about Michael Caine is that voice. We played a scene for him from the movie The Trip, where Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon argue over who does the better impression of him.
Right, so Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed. It gets very specific. It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it, all right? You're not doing it the way he speaks. You're not doing it with the kind of... And you don't do the broken voice when he gets very emotional. When he gets very emotional indeed. She was only 16 years old. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's Michael Caine.
A clip from the movie The Trip. Now, I don't know how...
The second guy was the best one.
The second one.
Yeah, because I don't speak slowly, as you can hear. I don't speak slowly, and I don't speak through my nose. But the first one sounded like he had a cold.
He did, rather.
But the second one I thought was brilliant.
Is that weird for you to be so imitable?
No, because I'm so used to it. Everybody does it. I mean, the first time I heard it, Peter Sellers did it. Peter always liked the latest thing. Everything that came out, and he had the first answer machine on a telephone that I'd ever heard. And when I phoned him, he was a friend, and I phoned him one day, and he wasn't in. And then I heard my voice saying, my name is Michael Caine, Peter Sellers is not in. Not many people know that. And that's where that phrase came from, because Peter invented it. But, I mean, I regard it as a compliment.
When we're talking about your influences, one person I should definitely mention from much earlier in your life is your mother, who you write about early in the book, Blowing the Bloody Doors Off. You were separated from her briefly, rather traumatically, as a child. There's a family that you stayed with that you write kind of kept you locked away in a cupboard when they went away for weekends.
Yeah, it's me and another boy called Clarence. We were both six. And these people took us in because of the Blitz. And my mother, I was only there 2 weeks, but she fed us on pilchards, tin pilchards, and that's all we ever had to eat, tin pilchards. And we, both of us, came out in spots and blotches and everything.
Pilchards are kind of like sardines, are they?
Yeah, pilchards are sardines. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're big sardines.
Okay.
They used to go away for the weekend, and so they would lock us in the cupboard under the stairs with some pilchard sandwiches and bottles of water, and they pick us up again on Sunday night or Monday morning. And my mother, who was trying to get down to see us, couldn't because the railways were shut because of the Blitz. The trains weren't running. There was after about 2 or 3 weeks, there was a lag in the Blitz, and the trains came, and she came down and saw us and went absolutely nuts and took us away, and took us away with her. I never again did she leave us alone. And she took us to a farm. We were evacuated from a sort of London slum to a wonderful farm in the country, and it changed my life forever.
You write in the book that your mother gave you your first acting job when you were three. Is that right?
Yeah. When the bailiffs used to come about to rent, she'd stand behind the door, and I opened the door. But she did it because I wasn't tall enough to do it. And then I'd look round at the bailiff and I'd say, "She's out," and slam the door. That was my job. That was my first acting job.
To be a convincing deterrent.
Yeah, I was very good.
At what point did it kind of hit you that this was something you could make a go of, acting?
Well, there were two points. There was one where I was given a part of a boy in Cinderella, and a little tiny part, and I went on. I got a laugh immediately, which I loved, but the reason was I had my flies were undone, so I went off and did that, and I thought, well, I got a laugh anyway. And then I played a robot in RUR, Rossum's Universal Robots, which is a very famous play, and I played a robot in that, and I got a review in the club magazine saying this man is a robot without expression or voice sounds, any sense in his voice. And Maurice Micklewhite, that was my real name, was perfect. So I thought, well, yeah, I got a good review for that. And then I was in a basketball team in the club, and we used to play in the basket court, which was on the roof. And I always went past this place where there was windows in the doors. There was always pretty girls. All the prettiest girls in the club were there. And then one day I was leaning on the door looking through. I was on my way up to basketball. And I fell in. And the woman thought, who was running the club, the class, thought I'd come to join. And I looked round and I saw this girl. I thought, I'd love to kiss her. Maybe I'll do a love scene with her. So I said yes. And that's how I became an actor. I grew to love it. I mean, not because I didn't get to kiss the girl, but I got to kiss the idea. And that's when I became an actor, when I was about 12, 13.
By the way, you mentioned your birth name, Maurice Micklewhite. Maurice Joseph Micklewhite. How did you get the name Michael Caine?
I got Michael Caine because I finished it. I was in the repertory for 9.5 years, and I came to London, and I got an agent and tried to get into television and get small parts in films. I was called Michael White then. I changed my name from Micklewhite to Michael White, I didn't have a phone, and so I used to go. We all used to work actors be in a basement of a theatre called the Arts Theatre, where you could get cheap coffee and sandwiches, and sit around and gossip all day, and no one threw you out. And I didn't have a phone, so I used to go to Leicester Square, which is kind of the Broadway of London, you know, with all the big cinemas and everything. And I would go there, and I'd get on the telephone, in the telephone booth, and phone my agent every evening to see if there was a part. And one night she said, "You've got a part," she said, "but you've got to join the Actors Trade Union now you're in London and in television." So I said, "Oh, yeah, fine, join it." She says, "It's called Equity." I said, "Yeah, I'll join Equity." Yes. Yeah, she said, "But there is another man called Michael White, already a member of Equity, so you can call yourself Michael, but you can't call yourself White." So I said, "Okay." She said, "And I need the number now, while you're on your name now, while you're on the phone, because I've got to speak to the people and say you're willing to play the part." So I said, "Okay." She says, "What do you want for a surname?" So I looked around the Leicester Square, and one of my favourite actors of all time was Humphrey Bogart, and it said Humphrey Bogart in the Caine Mutiny, and I said, "Caine." She said, "How do you spell it?" I looked up. I said, "Caine," and that's how I became Michael Caine. And it's a good job I didn't go to the Leicester Square Theatre, otherwise I'd have been called Michael 101 Dalmatians.
You would have had one of the more fascinating names in the movies, though.
No, how about one... that for a name? Michael 101 Dalmatians.
No one fantastic. Would have forgotten.
Yeah.
You'd have been very memorable. I know there are people listening to this who are into cinema or film, possibly as actors or filmmakers, and you write in the book that movie acting is a delicate balance between preparation and spontaneity. What do you mean by that?
Well, you must prepare the dialogue and what you're going to do so much that it's absolutely natural. You must never get anyone to read the other lines when you're rehearsing, because when the actor says the lines to you, you've never heard the line before. You don't know what he's going to say in a conversation, and then you have to think of your answer, and you have to keep it like human beings. When I was in the theatre, I got two lessons in that. One was I was playing a drunk in rehearsing in the theatre when I was very young. And the producer stopped me. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm drunk in this scene, sir." He said, "I know you're drunk in this scene." He said, "What are you doing?" So I said, "I'm playing a drunk." He said, "No." He said, "A drunk is a man who is trying to walk straight and speak properly. You're an actor who is trying to walk crooked and speak blurred." He said, "Have you got it?" And I thought, I didn't know at the time, but that was my first lesson in movie acting. You've got to be the person, not the actor.
One other thing.
And there was a second one he told me about,
yeah,
too. I had to cry. And I cried in this scene, and he said, "Stop a minute. What are you doing, Michael? I said, "Well, I'm crying in this scene, so in this bit, I just where I cry." He said, "I know what you're doing, what you're supposed to be doing, but what are you doing?" He said, "A man will not cry. Whatever happens, he will fight till his last breath not to cry." He said, "You're an actor trying to his last breath to cry." He said, "Remember that." He said, "People don't try to do things. If they don't like it, they try not to do things."
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about kind of where Hollywood is now and where it may be going by way of sort of wrapping up. I know that you've got a lot of stories to tell, I'm sure, about just the changes you've seen in the industry. The latest ones that we've been talking about had been about just how technology is changing Hollywood with the advent of Netflix and Hulu and Amazon getting into the game. Lately, we've been talking about how the Me Too movement has been changing Hollywood. In your book, you write that you consider yourself a feminist. I wonder how you're seeing these kind of social changes affect the work that you and other actors do.
Well, I think for a start, I mean, movies now are great big spectacular things that you want to go to the cinema to see on the big screen with a massive stereophonic sound. But also you have places like Netflix where people are getting paid a great deal of money to be on television, and they're playing the sort of movies that we all did in the old days before they did great big... so many great big spectacles, you know. And I think if I was a young actor now, I'd really be sort of puzzled as to what to do with my career, you know. Huh. You know, so there has developed a massive gap between the cinema that I knew and the cinema today.
And you think that if you were a young man coming up today, you'd really have to kind of rack your brain to figure out where you belonged, where you were had the, where
yeah,
you had the best fit?
Yeah, I mean, I knew I belonged in the theater, and when they told me I belonged in film, I was so happy. But, I don't see them, say for instance, a dialogue, heavy dialogue picture like Alfie, you know? I don't know how that would go down today if it was released with all these great big, wonderful, you know, multi-million pound movies. Alfie would have been on Netflix, I think.
Although it's funny, you know, you look at a movie like Dark Knight, though, and there's this blend between this great dialogue, like the clip we played earlier, and then this big budget action. And I feel like, I don't know if you see this, but I don't know. I think that some audiences with the big movies, whether it's Dark Knight or Black Panther or, you know, some of the others, they want a little bit of both. They want the big flashbang, but they want a story, too.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, and that would give us a chance. But it's not this thing where you can go on making one picture after another, which are small pictures about real people.
What about the social impact of things like the Me Too movement? I mean, you've worked with one of the most prominent men in Hollywood, Woody Allen, who's been accused. You won an Oscar for your role in his movie, Hannah and Her Sisters. What about just the social changes and how they affect being a movie actor?
Well, they've affected it tremendously, and I'm very pleased. I'm very much a feminist. And I've always worried all the time I've been in the movie business, I've always heard about the casting couch. But I didn't realize it was as serious as it turned out with actual physical assaults and exposures and things like that. Because I thought the casting couch was the pretty young actress came in to get the part. The producer said, yeah, you've got the part. Now I want you to do this. And she said, no. And he said, you haven't got the part. And so she walks out. And I thought this was a terrible thing to happen to young actresses, but nothing could be done about it because the producers were so powerful. But I never thought of anything physical happening in it. It was just a thing, you know. But now it has completely changed. But one of the things is you sort of use the difficulty, which is one of my phrases in the book about how I see my life, is that this is a terrible thing that's gone on about all these men who have been assaulting these actresses and taking advantage of them in their power position. And I think it's disgusting and disgraceful. But out of everything, no matter how bad it is, there is something good. And what has come from good out of this is that for the next 50 years, no young actress will be propositioned in order to get a part by the producer. Because if he did, he'd be in the newspapers the next day.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I wonder what's next for you. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? What do you want to experience or learn next?
Oh, me, I write occasionally. The next thing I want to do, I've never written a fiction book, so I'm going to write a fiction book. I'm still playing old characters. I get characters so old now. I die at the end. I keep dying. I'm very good at dying.
Well, you got to have a niche, you know. You got to have a shtick.
That's my niche. I'm a new dyer. Dire Straits. But the great joy in my life is I have three grandchildren. And I always thought grandparents, as I got older, I mixed with older people, and grandparents were always on about their grandchildren. I thought, I wish they'd shut up about their bloody grandchildren, old bores, you know. Now I'm one of them. I've got grandchildren, and I never stop talking about them, and I have to stop myself looking around the room and seeing the people go, I wish he'd shut up a minute. And because I have three grandchildren, two boys and a girl, 9 and 10, twins are 9, and my whole life is devoted to them, and utterly, I'm so joyful at having them. I cannot tell you. So, I mean, I'm 85. You get to that age, and you say, "Well, I'm going to die soon." And then you get the grandchildren, and you go, "No, I'm not. I've got a whole life ahead of me, and that's what I've got, and I'm very, very happy."
Michael Caine, the new memoir is called "Blowing the Bloody Doors Off and Other Lessons in Life." Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking to us.
The pleasure for me too, sir. Thank you.
Remember, you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app or whatever app you like. We'd be honored if you wrote us a review. If you're new to podcasts, you'll find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1A.org/staff.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.